Hello, welcome to Cherry Beckert's GovCon podcast, where we discuss current government contracting trends, compliance matters, and best practices to guide federal contractors forward. My name is Eric Poppy. I'm a managing director with Cherry Beckert in our GovCon consulting group. And with me today is Jeff Vanessa, senior manager on our team in the GovCon consulting group and a former DC auditor. And today we are starting actually a new podcast series on the cost accounting standards. And so today is the first part of that multi-part series on CAS, and we are going to be giving a general overview on what CAS is. So, you know, first off, everyone grab your cup of coffee, your beer, your water, glass of wine, whatever suits your fancy, because this is a really exciting topic, but it's very practical and needs to be discussed for growing government contractors and also large government contractors who are, you know, potentially having M&A activity, are going after CAS cover contracts, are just getting into the cost plus world, or getting out of the commercial world. So a lot of different ways to think about this, that where CAS could become applicable. So I'm going to stop rambling for a second. Jeff, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you mean to tell me that not everyone loves CAS? Is it just former DCA auditors? I mean, I know I read this pretty much every night when I can't fall asleep. You just pull up CAS and instantly you're out.
You know, it is the cost accounting standards. You know, I it's probably a love-hate relationship with most finance, compliance, and accounting staff at these contractors. But I guess to really start us right off, can you just tell us what are the cost accounting standards? You know, what is this and why are we talking about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are 19 CAS standards, which are standards and rules that were promulgated by the 41 USC 422. So they're actually designed to achieve uniformity and consistency in cost accounting practices. So those standards are really designed to improve the accuracy of cost data by ensuring that it's based on consistent definitions and principles. So really, the U.S. government, what they want is a reliable basis for comparison and decision making. So that's why this is important to them. This really allows them to be able to compare proposals from contractor to contractor, knowing that they're all following the same set of rules and standards. And it also allows them to, you know, review proposals from a single contractor year over year. So those follow on actions. And I know even when I was at DCAA, one of the bigger changes I kind of saw in the acquisition environment was kind of a shift towards procuring based on actuals. So sometimes there's proposals not coming in. They're leaning heavily on actuals. So that's where CAS kind of really does kind of come into play in that consistency and uniformity to be able to rely on that data.
Thanks. And I know some people are being or might be asking, you know, what's the difference between FAR versus CAS? And that's a topic that where a lot of the CAS or some of the CAS standards are based off of the same principles of the FAR. But the FAR is mainly focused on allowability, cost reasonableness, and, you know, ending claims to the federal government. You know, what's direct versus indirect? Does this cost fall into one of the cost principles? You know, where CAS mainly focuses more on the measurement and allocation of those costs and gives fundamental techniques and our fundamental requirements and techniques for application for that. So, you know, I think that if you'll definitely see some overlap between the FAR and the CAS, but there are some distinct differences. And I kind of think of like CAS is kind of like the full blown standards that you have to go for when you're, you know, working towards when you're growing as a government contractor.
Definitely agree.
Yeah. So from a standard standpoint, you know, we keep talking about these standards. Do you mind just kind of talking a little bit about what are we talking about for standards? Is this, you know, what does that entail?
Yeah. So I guess to me, and I guess how we looked at it at DCA is they're kind of split into four main categories where they could kind of fall into. There's disclosure requirements, internal controls, various cost principles, and then accounting ethics. So when you actually go and look at the CAS, look at the actual regulations on each one of them, for each of those 19 standards, they specify the purpose of the CAS, really, why does it exist? What is it there for? There's definitions in there. So it defines all the terms, if there's any terms that you might not be familiar with. It has the fundamental requirement, which is the actual requirement of the CAS. There's also some techniques for application as well as illustrations. And those illustrations can be pretty helpful because they go, if you go and look at them, there's good examples, but there's also bad examples. And I know when you're working with DCAA, they're not very privy to providing you with examples, which is where, you know, when you actually go and look at the standards, it can be pretty helpful. There's also a couple of the standards that specify the interpretation, the exemption, and the effective dates. And the effective dates are important, and that'll kind of come into play, you know, if you are going to be CAST covered based on the date that your contract is awarded. So looking at the CAST, if anyone does go look at them, I know I've mentioned there's 19. They number from 401 to 420. And for some reason, 419 is skipped. It's considered being reserved. And honestly, Eric, I don't know if you know why, but I don't know why it's reserved and why they did it like that. I just chalk it up to it's the United States government. And if it made sense, they probably wouldn't do it.
So if you were the government, what would you decide to put for 419?
I probably would have just made 420, 419, and then if you needed to add another one, or keep 420 reserved.
I really just want someone to play a quick April Fool's joke and put, like, you know, that family recipe, or, you know, maybe just a really good dad joke into 419 and see if anyone, you know, bats an eye, just to see what happens. But so I know from a CAST standpoint, people, you know, we see a lot of RFPs that come out that state, you know, or you have reps and starts saying, are you CAST covered? And I feel like we talk a lot with clients and with prospects that, you know, CAST is not specific to the company or the contractor or a specific government agency or higher ed, but it actually CAST follows the contract. And that being that CAST applicability is really a two-step process. First, you have to determine if that award that has been awarded or is being negotiated is CAST covered. And then if it is, then, you know, will it be full or modified CAST covered? So kind of CAST light being modified or full CAST of all 19 standards. And modified CAST coverage is you have to follow CAST 401, 2, 5, and 6, which a lot of those, you know, relate to, again, they're kind of very similar to FAR Part 31. And estimating versus accumulating, consistent reporting, and cost accounting period. But, you know, how about we dive in a little bit to modified coverage versus full coverage? You know, when does this apply to a contract and what are those certain dollar thresholds?
Yeah, sure. So I'll kind of start from the beginning. So CAST technically applies to all negotiated contracts in excess of $2 million, unless a specific exemption applies. And the CAST does list 10 exemptions. I know a lot of you were probably thinking, I thought CAST applies when you hit that $7.5 million mark. So that is called the trigger contract. So contracts of less than $7.5 million at the time of award, as long as the business is not currently performing any CAST covered contracts or subcontracts over $7.5 million, you do not have to have CAST coverage. However, once you hit $7.5 million, that's what they call that trigger contract. That's probably the term that you're used to hearing, that trigger contract. So that is when CAST coverage does come in. And then subsequent to that, it would be any contracts over $2 million, unless you meet any of these exemptions. So anything under $2 million in this $2 million amount that we're talking about is that Truth in Negotiations Act, or TINA, as a lot of people refer to it, the TINA threshold, same thing for cost or pricing data.
And one thing to jump in and add, that $2 million, that threshold for $2 million for TINA was raised a few years back. So if you're looking at old guidance, it might give a different number.
Yeah, probably $750K bumped up to $2 million. Yeah, so the first exemption is anything under $2 million. The second is for sealed bid contracts. Third is contracts with small businesses. The fourth would be contracts with foreign governments. The fifth would be contracts where price is set by law or regulation. The sixth would be contracts that are firm fixed price or T&M for the acquisition of commercial items. The seventh would be firm fixed price contracts awarded on the basis of adequate price competition without submission of certified cost or pricing data. So there would be no requirement for that certified cost or pricing data. The eighth one that we kind of just hit on is if it's under $7.5 million. The ninth would be if the prime contract is exempt from CAST, then any subcontract that's under that is also exempt from CAST, even if you have other CAST covered contracts. And then the 10th one, which, you know, is probably a little more unfamiliar to most, is subcontracts under the NATO PHM SHIP program that are performed outside of the United States. So those are all the exemptions that would exempt you from having to comply with CAST. And I know, Eric, you kind of mentioned about the full coverage and the cast coverage. So I'll kind of just go into right now when full coverage applies and when modified cast coverage applies. So to kind of just circle back, so full coverage means that you're going to need to comply with all 19 cast standards. And it's all 19 cast standards that are in effect on the date of your contract award. And this happens when receiving a single award of $50 million or more. So if you win an award that's $50 million, you're automatically full cast covered unless you meet one of those exemptions. Also, when you do when a business receives a non-exempt contract award, when having $50 million or more in net cast-covered contracts during the preceding cost period. So that would also have you being full cast compliant or full coverage. Now, modified cast coverage, as you mentioned before, you only have to apply with those four cast standards that are pretty close to some of the cost principles that are in FAR. That was the CAS 401, which is consistency in estimating, accumulating, and reporting costs. CAS 402, which is consistency in allocating costs incurred for the same purpose. CAS 405, which is accounting for unallowable costs. And then CAS 406, which is cost accounting period. Now, modified CAS coverage applies when you hit that $7.5 million trigger contract. When the total net CAS covered awards in the preceding cost accounting period are less than $50 million, because if they were over $50 million, then you'd be going back to the full coverage. And as you kind of mentioned this before, it's important to note that modified CAS coverage applies to the lifetime of a contract. I know you talked about this, Eric, that CAS applies to a contract, not a contractor, not a federal agency. So when you are modified CAS coverage, that applies to the lifetime of that contract, even if you receive subsequent full CAS covered contracts. However, once you do receive a full CAS covered contract, any subsequent contract that you might be awarded in that same cost accounting period, if you're not meeting an exemption, would also need to be full CAS covered.
So a couple things, let's just kind of summarize this, because I think these are two major topics that we really wanted to hit on. We get a lot of questions about. First, that exemption, or actually first kind of the trigger event. So it's, and there's, we'll get a little bit into this disclosure statements too. If you have contracts that are coming in less than 7.5 and you have not had that triggering event, doesn't matter if it's 6 million, doesn't matter if it's 4 million, 2 million, but until you have that 7.5, that is the event that then you need to start tracking to up to that aggregate of 50 million. Or a single contract value of 50 million or more. And I use the word contract value there specifically because a lot of times people are like, well, you know, I've only been funded for 15 million of that 50 million, or just for simple. And well, it's value. And I know there's a lot of questions that pop up about IDIQs and what do we do with all these IDIQs? And is it a task order level? Is it the IDIQ? We're still waiting on guidance from the CAS board on if this follows the IDIQ or if it's the task order level. There has been some case law that each task order is considered its own kind of standalone contract with its own additional terms. However, the conservative approach would be, depending on what that floor and ceiling is for the contract, is going at that IDIQ level. And if you then putting things into place, other companies take it at the task order level. So there's a lot of questions around how does this apply to IDIQs that we can't answer today. For those exemptions, I want to talk about this for a second too. I hear a lot, and Jeff, I would love to hear your thoughts too. Like companies saying, well, it's a fixed firm price contract. It's not CAS covered. Doesn't matter. But you know, it's honing in on that based on adequate price competition without submission of certified cost and pricing data. So if certified cost and pricing data was submitted, or if there wasn't really adequate competition, CAS would still apply to that contract.
Yep, that's correct.
So that's a big one. It's interesting too, the contracts with small businesses, you can tell that, you know, we talk with companies all the time of wanting to leverage as long as they can those small business awards in those vehicles, even after they potentially graduated, because anything awarded under that IDIQ that might be awarded to a small business, it has that veil, and then those task orders are awarded to small businesses. So you would be able to keep those from becoming CAS covered or, you know, kind of in that aggregate bucket to the 50 million. So with that, I know I just went rambling a little bit on common things that we see, but from a disclosure statement standpoint, we've talked about this a few times. And for those of you who are not familiar with the disclosure statement, this is a written description of the cost accounting practices and procedures that the contractor uses. So contractors are required to submit a disclosure statement before the award of a CAS-covered contract of 50 or more. Additionally, contractors are required to submit a disclosure statement on once total CAS coverage hit 50 million. So you hit the triggering event 7.5, add it all up, you're at 50 million. In that cost accounting period, then you'd have to submit your disclosure statement. Now, one thing that I feel like we talk again a lot to contractors. If you're starting to bump up against that 50 million, or you're thinking about it, or you're starting to go after really large awards, it's sometimes a really good practice to draft your disclosure statement and have it ready to go, because you can make changes to it. But then if you're going after an award that you have to submit your disclosure statement as part of the proposal package, or sometimes it says that if this award will trigger CAS, submit your disclosure statement as part of it, like you have it ready to go.
Right. And then you're not worried about putting together a proposal and building a full up disclosure statement from the ground up.
Yep. Yep. And it's very true. And a lot of times for the disclosure statement, you can outline or leverage cost accounting policies or practices, even sometimes pieces from maybe a cost narrative if it's a well-written one, to your disclosure statement. Do you want to talk a little bit about the firm thresholds when it comes to when a disclosure statement is required?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, contractors are required to submit their disclosure statement, like you said, before the award of a CAS covered contract of 50 million or more. Mentioned that. So a lot of times we do see, though, when that proposal or that RFP comes out, that the requirement is if it's going to trigger CAS for you, have it ready to go. The other time, like you said, once you hit that $7.5 million trigger mark is when you do need to start counting and tracking within a cost accounting period the number of awards that you have that are CAS covered. Because once you do hit 50 million, that's when you're required to submit that disclosure statement, following the form that they have out there. It's a pretty nice form, which again, kind of demonstrates how they want consistency and uniformity across various contractors.
I will say, if anyone is downloading the CAS DS-1, that's the form that you'll see. Sometimes it is buggy when you use it in PDF and you're trying to type things in. So heads up to our listeners out there. Sometimes it's easier to use it in Word and copy and paste descriptions in. That's from a lot of user error for myself.
Speaking with from experience.
You have some experience there of trying to navigate PDF and getting very frustrated with it sometimes. Or you put it in a Word and you're playing with the margins and you're trying to make the formatting work in Word. As you can tell, I'm more of an Excel guy. But with that, who's in charge of governing CAS?
Absolutely. So the Cognizant Federal Agency Official, or the acronym that you've probably seen or heard of, is CFAO, for a contractor is the one who is responsible for administering the CAS and for making the required determinations and findings. So now if you contract with multiple federal agencies, the responsibility typically falls to the federal agency that has the highest dollar amount of your contracts. So keep in mind that could change year over year. There's typically a little bit of bickering of who's going to take it, who's actually going to make these determinations and be charged with that governance. But typically that's how it goes. So while that CFAO has the responsibility for administering the CAS, everyone always their favorite, DCAA. DCAA performs CAS audits and has other audits that contain procedures to test for CAS compliance. So a few of the audits that contain CAS procedures are forward pricing rate proposals and then just forward pricing proposals, termination audits, incurred cost audits, and then business system audits, in which DCAA performs three, which are the accounting system audits, the estimating system audits, and the MMAS audits. So there's procedures within each of those to check for various CAS, like on forward pricing, a cost accounting period is always one that's pretty much in all of them. And then estimating and accumulating is one you would see in proposals. FPRPs with forward pricing rate proposals and incurred costs, you might see CAS 410 with G&A. So there's not all of them, not every single standard is in there, but there are various ones in there. Additionally, DCAA has CAS compliance audits for each of the 19 standards. And then they also have non-compliance audits. And a non-compliance audit is really just more of a deep dive if a non-compliance is found in any of those aforementioned audits that I kind of brought up. So if something is brought up, you know, where they find something in a proposal and, you know, they're trying to get the proposal out quick and don't really have enough time to really deep dive into, was this a CAS non-compliance? They would kind of kick that over to a non-compliance assignment, where they call it, and they would just look at that one specific CAS.
You know, To close this out, I know we're coming up on time here. I think that it'd be great for us to talk a little bit about the benefits of having to abide by CAS. And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about this, being like, wow, this sounds like a massive hurdle that we have to go through. And yes, while it sounds intimidating, and, you know, Jeff, you just outlined those audits that all might be coming into play anyways, it's one of those that every contractor has to get ready for. And if you continue to do well and grow in the federal space, that these requirements will come in. But the good thing with doing this is, and probably the biggest positive is, that one, you really understand your costs because you have to document them. And, you know, the time to do any cost accounting changes is, we always joke, is before you become full, or before you have to deal with CAS. So that's when you create new rate pools. That's when you try to do allocations, because once you do document this and you have to follow the standards, you have to go through then a process for any cost accounting change, which we'll get into in future podcasts. But the real benefit is that you have a better understanding of your costs, which in turn allows you to have better cost controls. And this will then flow through to impact your budgeting practice, your forecasting practice, your accumulating practice, and so on. You know, and the result of that could be increase in efficiencies and assisting with identifying, you know, what costs are necessary versus unnecessary. You'll have more reliable data and be more consistent information that then goes before management to make better decisions, more accurate decisions, and consistent too, which the government really wants to see, is that consistency, which you outlined, Jeff, in the very beginning of, the whole goal is consistent, reliable data, so the government can look at kind of apples to apples of proposals. But I think the one of the biggest pieces is that, yes, this is more of a documentation exercise. Yes, you might be more pigeonholed into certain practices for your company, and you can't be, you know, creating a pool here or there. But the good thing is that across your contracts, it's all the same. So you can really see an increase. You have a more granular view on the profitability of those contracts and really understanding the margins and the costs. So I think that's probably the biggest thing is, yes, it's a pain, but you really get that visibility into hopefully helping to drive up margins. So with that, we're pretty much at time. Jeff, any closing thoughts?
No, just if you can, make sure and grab a cup of coffee when you're digging into CAS. Make sure you stay awake. It's a fun, exciting topic. But yeah, like Eric said, we're going to be hitting on a couple different parts of CAS in the series coming up. So if you have any questions, let us know.
Well, thank you. And, you know, here at Cherry Becker, we do have a bunch of professionals who specialize in dealing with the CAS. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. And we thank everyone for joining us today. And as you mentioned, please keep an eye out for our other podcasts on this series. On the cost accounting standards or on business systems or other topics that are also coming out at this time. And we appreciate everyone for tuning in and listening. And please make sure to follow us on wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Thanks.